Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. This is Dan Turchin, host of AI and the Future of Work, advisor at Insight Finder, the system of intelligence for IT operations, and CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. Well, we learned about the Kenyan economy last week and how technology is addressing the hunger pandemic in East Africa from Joe Raymond at Victory Farms. This week, we're going to continue our discussion about international perspectives on AI and the future of work. I'm fascinated by this idea that globalization and AI are really part of the same discussion. The irony is whether we talk about the world getting bigger or smaller, we're right. And whether we talk about technology creating or eliminating jobs, we're right. One thing that's not controversial is that AI is disrupting every industry and, importantly, in every country. There's never been a more exciting time to be a high-tech entrepreneur. There have never been more opportunities to improve how we work and live. My advice, question everything. Find an industry that hasn't been changed in a decade. Then go figure out how to break it and fix it. Today's guest has done that many times. Over the past 30 years, Denis Jacquet has been a pillar of the entrepreneurial ecosystem in France. He's an accomplished author, an entrepreneur, a speaker, a media personality, having been featured numerous times on radio and TV. He has written extensively about the future of work and specifically the digitization of labor. His next entrepreneurial adventure is challenging what we thought we knew about the post-pandemic future of business interaction. Denis is helping governments wake up to the pandemic mistakes they've made, and he's helping businesses take advantage of the changing labor market. Thanks in advance to Philippe Kass from Topio Networks for the introduction to Denis. There's a lot to unpack in today's discussion. I can't wait to get started. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to welcome Denis Jacquet to the podcast. Denis, welcome. Why don't you start by sharing a little bit about your background and how you got into this space?
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure. Even more pleasure with a 9 hours difference, because it gives me 9 hours to think about what I will be saying to you. So basically, you know, the bad French humor, but I am an addict. So I must confess that I have been addicted to entrepreneurship for the last 25, almost 30 years, you're right. And I don't feel that I need to go to rehab, because I even want to take it even a little bit further. So I graduated from a law school and a business school almost at the same time. So I thought for some time like I could be a tax lawyer. Actually, I did it 30 years ago during 3 years. But quite rapidly, I realized that I was better at breaking the rules than following them. So that's where I started to my first company. So I started altogether 6 or 7 companies. I sold them all, not unicorns, so small and medium, nice businesses. The last one was in the e-learning sector. So I spent in this course, I spent 10 years abroad, traveling the world to expand VC learning companies in 8 different countries, came back in France. I started what became one of the largest entrepreneurs network in France, who became quite popular. And yeah, that's where I became one of the leading, let's say, voices in media about entrepreneurship. And so I was also 4 years ago started a think tank about the impact of the new business models, technologies on jobs, on the what we call the legacy companies, on the fabric of society, on everything. And I became quite passionate about that. And that's why I became, let's say, an author. So very reasonably and with very humble, but I will be releasing my third book in 3 weeks. At the end of April. And that's where I came up with this idea of creating the Day One movement. And the Day One movement is a part of non-profit and about a part of profit. So there's clubs and events. So next October, you will have four events in the world. And it's mainly about how do we leverage technology to impact positively the world. That's what we are trying to do. And the nonprofit part is a foundation, which is basically to design the largest barometer in the world to anticipate the changes in jobs. So I think that jobs is a very important matter, and I don't think we take too much care of it at this stage anywhere in the world, and I want to make a deep focus on this one. And there's what we call work groups. So we have 10 work groups with almost 70 large international companies working on specific topics to make sure that we have an impact on societies, on people, on, let's say, call it humanity all around the world. So that's what I'm doing, even if I'm also working on a new project that came out of a pandemic and a few thoughts about this revolution that should be happening in the conference industry, but that's where I'm staying now.
So much there to talk about. You are clearly a Renaissance man. So you've written about the mutation of jobs. Talk us through what that means to you and how is technology impacting the future of jobs?
I think that we have a very positive vision about the impact of technologies, but not only technologies, on new business models as well. So I don't know if you take the example of China, for example, the largest press companies in China with the largest valuation doesn't have any journalists. So it's not only about technologies, it's also the new way of doing things based on technologies, but also the new business models. So I think that in many ways, we are quite right in thinking that technologies could, let's say, heal the world or impact positively so many things in so many different sectors. And I think it's true, but I think that we leave it a little bit too much to chances. So it's not that we certainly have a vision, but we think that at some point technology could be solving everything. So that's okay. Let's do it as it is and don't too much interact and try to harness the technology or try to control the technology, because you should leave the technology do what she does best. And I think that it's a little bit of a waste, because we have a brain and we should be able to build not a vision, but many visions. Because the vision for someone living in California, in the heart of Africa, in the east of Asia, in Brazil, is not the same. So what they are expecting from a government, from technologies, from the future is not the same depending on their culture, where they are standing at this stage. So I think we should work more on having a vision, know exactly what should be driving the technologies, and also prepare a plan B. Because I've been working quite a lot with this consulting firm that you know, which is called McKinsey, but also Accenture and all these big consulting firms. And recently they did two studies. And one was about the Black Americans. And they said that most of them in the US are in the bad cities with the bad qualifications in the bad industries. And they made a report which is quite frightening, saying that if the automation is moving up, going faster, then the Black Americans will be completely behind. And certainly they won't think that technologies is a good thing. So I think we should anticipate, have plan Bs, and make sure that we can use the technologies for the best and to include everyone. So that's mainly, and another example is Foxconn. As you know, Foxconn, that's this Taiwanese company, certainly the largest in the world, 1.5 million workers. Two-thirds or three-quarters of them are low-qualified people. And the founder of Foxconn said, well, I think that 1 million of my workers will be replaced by robots within 10 years. So the question is, what will we do with low-qualified Chinese and Taiwanese with no job tomorrow? 1 million is huge. And if you multiply it by so many countries in the world, it's a social, political, even democratical problem, because these people, if they don't think that they have a future, they will certainly not vote for democratic people. So that's my feel. I think that's a good timing to work on that, to anticipate, to have plan B and maybe plan C, and make sure that inclusion is one of the main driver for them, for technologies and new business models.
So let's say you're asked to coach European governments about how to embrace new technology to avoid some of the social and political upheaval that you described, like maybe what's ahead from Foxconn. What's your advice?
Well, that would be ambitious on my side, but at least first thing would be to open their eyes, because when you think about it, China is moving fast, the Silicon Valley, but mainly the US is still moving fast. Israel is always moving faster. Korea, that is also a very innovative country, but mainly the US and China, they are taking risk. They are going toward the future. They are invest in the future. And in Europe, they are speaking about a strategy for new technologies. I mean, we are, come on, 2021, and we are still not, we don't have even the beginning of a strategy on artificial intelligence, on data. So it's mainly more defensive than attacking. And I don't see, Europe boasts itself to be the largest economic space in the world. If you combine these 27 countries, that's true. But as a united force, it's not true, because it's 27 very different markets with different languages. It's not a single market, really. And there's no strategy. And we saw it exactly during the COVID crisis and the pandemic, because suddenly you realize that that's the only continent in the world with less than 10% of people vaccinated. And we are still lagging behind. So I would say, open your eyes, go faster, invest massively. We have so many nice talents, and you know that in Silicon Valley, because there are so many talented French data scientists. Most of them are in the top 20 of the 50 largest American companies. So we have the talents, but we are not able to translate these talents into scalable companies. And the main thing is that we are a lot about regulation, and regulation is becoming a kind of prison where that kills innovation. And that's because the technocratic side of Europe is gaining over the entrepreneurial side of all these guys. They have never been working in their lives. They have been working for governments, but they never created anything. So they don't understand what is going on in the world. And so that's why I'm very frightened. And I shouldn't say that, because I should be shameful and stay in my country and fight for it. But the reason why I'm moving to the US for the second or third time in my life is because I want my kids to grow in a country that is looking forward in the future, and not a country that is looking at their feet and not doing anything, taking any risk. So it's a matter of open your eyes, take more risk, invest massively, give a better valuation to the business models, give their chance to all these talents that we have in Europe that are really great. But at this stage, that's not what they are doing. So a little bit frightened about the future of Europe, to be honest with you.
Kai-Fu Lee wrote a book called AI Superpowers, comparing the rise of AI technology in China versus Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. Now, he shares some similar theses with you. Based on what you've been talking about and, you know, what we know from Dr. Lee's book, what are your thoughts about moving to China with your family instead of the West? Maybe they've figured it out long before we have.
You know, basically what I think is that you have two countries in the world with a real vision. So, and maybe inside the US, Silicon Valley is something very special. So you have a vision, which is partly liberal and sometimes even libertarian vision, which is, let things happen. Let's invest massively. Let's see what will be happening. And if something wrong, we will be using this huge amount of money that we are doing to heal the things, to correct the course of things, and that's it. And that's a vision. And somewhere it should preserve democracy, to make sure that people have access to education, to information, to almost everything, health, education, all that stuff. So that's really a real legacy about the vision of a very, very liberal economy that you have in the US, and it's closer to my vision, of course. But when you think about China, it's certainly a place that I respect, because I've got this kind of admiration, not for the political regime, but for the way that this government, which is managed by communist guys, think about how enlightened, how fast, how brilliant is their strategy. Then they were so late in AI, in data, in entrepreneurship, in everything. And in less than 30 years, they catched up so rapidly that even Eric Schmidt at Google said 5 years ago, these guys are catching up, it's going fast. And I spoke to Keifu Li that you mentioned a few minutes earlier in your introduction. And I spoke quite extensively with him. In his book, he said it's a gladiator economy. So it means that people are coming into this arena. They want to be rich. They want to build they want to become billionaires. But at the same time, the government is saying, wait, you can be a billionaire in a communist country, but don't forget that all the data should be coming back to the government to make sure that we keep the same kind of political government and the Communist Party. And when you think about it, it's very strange, because that's the first country in the world able to have at the same time a very capitalist economy and a very purely communist kind of government. So that's not the way and the kind of country where I want to live. But you have to respect the quality of their work, the speed to which, and the strategy that they have. So, and you know, I've been in the French team for running when I was 17, and you're always better when you have a good competitor. So the good thing about China is that if we don't want this model to become predominant, we have to be better than them. So it's when you don't have any competitors, you're a bad competitor yourself. So I see it as an opportunity to provide something different and prove that we can remain in a liberal economy without going through this kind of authoritarian economy that they have there. But at the same time, I think that with all these privacy issues, with data which is more and more open to a few very large, even US companies, I think that we are progressively moving to a place where it's not government, but someone or somebody or some company will in some way control us. So that's something we should be thinking about.
Talked about this on this podcast before, but I hope that the rise of China as an AI superpower is a wake-up call to Silicon Valley. We have become complacent, and I think there's an opportunity to be more humble and more hungry, because like you said, maybe your example from being on the French running team, we have a worthy adversary, and it doesn't need to be it doesn't need to become political or incendiary in nature, but we can make each other better by realizing that AI is a data problem. We have more data together. AI requires a lot of trained data scientists. We should maintain open borders and celebrate innovation as opposed to seeing each other as political adversaries. So one of the projects that you mentioned you're working on is related to how the future of business conferences will forever be changed by the pandemic. Give us a little tease. What is it that you're working on?
Yeah. In fact, you know that most of the innovation are coming out either, I would say, observation or curiosity or traumatism. And we have been going through this very traumatic experience with a pandemic. And because I've got this day one events, I'm now, let's say, a little part of this conference industry. And when I was looking to the three main players in this industry, I realized that these guys were waiting, trying to raise funds to make sure that they can stay there until the pandemic is over and they can go back to business as usual. And I say, wow. So a little bit like education when I started VC Learning Company 20 years ago. Education was only face-to-face, physical training, and suddenly you were speaking with people about having distance education, remote things, and they said, wow, it won't be working because people like to be in a classroom and have a professor, and that's it. And I did a conference a few weeks back in Monaco, and they told me in 2021, well, now, because of pandemic, we are moving faster into the online education. I say, wow, it took 20 years for you to go in that space. That's very surprising. And I think that the conference world is exactly doing the same that what I saw in the education business 20 years ago. So I think that certainly I realized that certainly people will go back into physical conference because we should not forget that we are animals. Still animals, and we need to be close to each other, feel each other, touch each other, hug each other, and we need that. We need this kind of physical interaction. It's chemical, it's inside our DNA. But at the same time, with the climate change and so many different factors, doesn't make sense to travel all around the world to speak during 15 minutes on a stage and go back to your place. So I think that there will be a huge impact on this conference industry. And I think that most of the major players didn't see it. They are not expecting it. They are just waiting for going back to business as usual. And we had an idea. I think it could potentially be a unicorn because there's a new way of addressing this conference business. And I think we found the magic trick and I'm working on it, and we will be soon going out of a forest and explain what we are doing in a few weeks, let's say 3 to 4 weeks, something like early May or early June. And we will be going after the European and the US market very soon. And I think it has the potential to become a huge stuff. So I'll be able to explain a little bit more to you very soon, I hope.
Well, that certainly is a cruel tease. I have two asks. One is that you let me invest before it becomes a unicorn, and then two is that when you're ready to launch the big vision, you come back on this podcast and we'll give you a big platform to launch it. How about that?
I would love that. Yes to both of your questions.
What's one thing that you think is going to change at work in, let's call it, 10 years, by 2030? That you think today might just seem like science fiction?
Well, I'm not sure, but let's play the game, because at some point you have to have crazy ideas and see how it unfolds. But I think that maybe tomorrow we won't be working with employees anymore. I mean, employees and independent workers would be in a kind of balance with each other. People will be able to work on a project inside a company from outside because they will be independent. And then suddenly, that's the end of a project. They will be able to another project in another company. And suddenly, even the education and training industry will be changing because some people from one industry will be able to become the trainers for someone outside another industry. But I think that at some point, when you think about Twitter or these guys that said, maybe you won't be coming back into an office because now remote home working will be the new normal. I think it's a little bit early because, again, we are humans and animals, and we need to be with each other, with one another, and be together, because we see at this point that we need to be together to have ideas, to work together, and doing it behind a Zoom or behind a Teams or whatever, there's something missing. But I think that progressively, because the young generation, they don't have any loyalty to a specific company or anything. They want to work on something meaningful. They want to focus on a project and leave and do something else. And they don't have this kind of anticipation by my generation and generation of our parents have to say, wow, in 30 years, I will still be in the same company, but I will be at C-level and I will be making so much money. I think the generation and the pandemic just accelerated this kind of trend. So I think that certainly 10 to 15, 20 years, I think working and organizing a company will be a very different story. So there will be a base of faithful, loyal people that will remain in the company because you need a memory, and people staying in your company, that's your brain and that's your memory, but also fresh blood and fresh people that will come just for a project and leave and go somewhere else. And even change of countries, change of industry, change of... And I think they don't have this kind of vision where I'm going to from A to B to C. No, they want to have this kind of linear things where they are excited by what they do and not thinking about the paycheck or the kind of career that our grandparents and parents were dreaming about. So I think it could be a big change because that will be a revolution in terms of management and the way we organize companies everywhere.
So we both have kids and we both have similar thoughts about the future of work. As a parent, what are the skills that you want your kids to be investing in so that they're relevant and so that they can be leaders in 10 years?
I think that it could be surprising, but what I'm trying to teach, because I had two lives, so I'm remarried, and but because it's a huge proportion of entrepreneurs that went through divorce, so I'm not an exception, but my three first kids are older now, so they are starting in their life, so there's not so much that I can do for them because they are already grown-ups, they have their ideas and things, but one of them became an entrepreneur and we are working quite a lot together, so I'm trying to share what I've been through as an entrepreneur, and it's very nice because he was not listening to me when he was 10 years or 15 years old, and now he listens very carefully because he thinks that his father is quite, let's say, regularly good and that he should take a few good ideas from me. But for Emma, she's 11 years old. One of the reasons we decided to go to the US is that I want her to be as much multicultural as possible. So because it means openness, to be open to diversity, different culture, different languages, different ways of looking at the world. And so my wife is from Africa. I was born in France. I'm part Catholic, part Jewish. So I'm very open to so many different things. And I want her to be super open to everything. And I think that people with curiosity, openness to diversity, able to make a synthesis of very different and sometimes things that seems antagonic in a certain way, suddenly able to do the synthesis and find the common ground into the diversity will be certainly the people with a huge success in the future. And I definitely think that being adaptable, being able to go from one place to one culture, from that will be the secret of the future leaders. And everything is getting combined, mixed and everything, even colors, even religions, people are getting married with each other. So we are going toward a larger diversity. So people able to play and have this kind of flexibility will certainly be the best. So I'm trying to teach her as much as I can to be adaptable, flexible, open. And I think that is even more important than doing the best university or the best business school or everything. I think we are going toward a very different world. I don't know if it's for her, but I think so, because she will be able to get into the professional world, what, in 12 to 15 years. So that's where things will be very, very different. And I want her to be open. So that's mainly what I'm trying to do with my kids.
So educate us about the entrepreneurial ecosystem in Europe. I am ignorant about a lot of the cultural differences. Last week, I mentioned we had a Kenyan entrepreneur talking to us about aquaculture and the application of technology to the African economy. But with respect to, you know, say your daughter and maybe, you know, at some point she's an entrepreneur like you, is there a reason why she couldn't participate in that kind of synthesis of ideas and that exposure to multiple cultures, like what you said is driving your move to the US? Could she not get that same kind of, you know, the same kind of environmental, the stimuli in Europe?
I think that, well, the first thing is that we are not the only country, because it's going everywhere around the world, but Europe is getting older. So that's the same in Russia, that's the same in Japan. You know, that's one of the oldest country. I don't think about their history, but when you say the average age in Japan is huge, and it's that's the same in Europe. So it means that when you don't have kids and you don't have a new generation coming behind, it means that at some time the growth is slowing, and certainly Europe is slowly declining. And when you read about the various reports or studies that has been done with major banks, consulting firms in the last 12 months because of a pandemic, they said that the two major victims would be Latin America and Europe. So the thing that mostly in Europe, people think that the past was better than the future. They don't think that they belong to the future anymore. They don't trust their governments anymore. And it's also almost the same because, you know, in the 70s, somebody born in the US had 90% chances to raise the social level of his parents. Now it's around 50%. And the study says that in 2030, even in the US, the chances to have a better life standards and all that kind of things could be anywhere between 20 and 30% compared to 90% 50 years ago. So, but still, what my feeling is that the US, the American, most of them believe in the future. And Europe is not believing in the future anymore. So the government has a strong presence, and people don't trust the politicians anymore. So it's going into a very wrong direction. And because there's no money and no growth anymore, people rely even more on the government, which is taking more taxes, killing the growth. And it's a kind of a vicious circle that we are going in. So that's why it's better for me to think about my daughter either in a, I would say, or in an emerging country, going to Africa or going even to Brazil or some place like that, or going to the US, because you still have a very good education system. The energy is there. It's thriving, at least in the large cities, because the center of the US is also having a lot of challenges and a lot of industries disappearing, jobs that are killed and everything. But at least in the large American cities, you can really think about the future. So that's mainly the difference. I think that people don't believe in Europe anymore.
Sounds rather dystopian.
Yeah, definitely. I don't love to say that, actually. Yeah.
But an important awakening. Now, we've gone way over time, but I got to get in this one last question. It's one of my favorites, and I got to hear how you respond to it. Your advice for a younger version of Denis?
I would try to be maybe more curious, as I said before. But I was curious, but not enough. Certainly, the second thing would to think about the balance between your professional and professional life. And I've never been better when my professional and personal life were really balanced. The third thing, because my father passed away almost 20 years now, is that you should spend more time with your parents. And when you are an entrepreneur, you don't have time for anyone. And that's something that I regret sometimes, quite often, actually. And I say, wow, I would have loved to spend more time with him. And so there's a few mistakes. And I would say, take care of your family. Wait until your professional life is more stable before you start something on your personal life. Because at some point, being an entrepreneur takes quite a huge toll on the personal life. So, and you need two feet to walk. So that would be mostly being more curious, take care about your family a little bit more, your parents, because they are not immortal, and try to be as curious and as possible and open to diversity. But for the rest, I think I won't be changing anything.
sage advice. I wish that we had had this conversation long ago for my personal benefit. Certainly the part about not appreciating the impact that the intensity of an entrepreneurial career has on personal life. Really astute. Well, Denise, this has been such a pleasure. I didn't want to cut us off early. I was so engaged in the conversation. We went a little over, but thank you so much for joining me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, I love that. And I will be very delighted to do it again when this new project is coming in.
You bet. I'm going to make sure that you honor that commit. And thanks again to Philippe, our mutual friend, Philippe Kaz, who made the introduction. This is Dan Turchin, your host of AI and the Future of Work. Thanks as always for listening. We are back next week with another fascinating guest.